Chapter 3 Desire. There are two tragedies in life. The first is not to get what you want. The other is to get it. Oscar Wilde and G.B. Shaw. They surfeited with honey and began to loathe the taste of sweetness, whereof a little more than a little is by much too much. Shakespeare, Henry IV, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 2. What does the lover want? If there is one thing Diotima got right, it was that love essentially involves desire. But what is desire? And what sorts of desire are characteristic of love? Some of the things lovers want are features desirable in any friendly relationship. Trust, intimacy, emotional resonance, companionship, concern for one another's welfare. To those, erotic love adds more specific desires, nowhere more compactly listed than in the Dowland song, to see, to hear, to touch, to kiss, to die, with thee again in sweetest sympathy. Note how casually Dowland's line plays on the double meaning of to die. Thinking of the erotic intensity of the moment, we can understand it in the orgasmic sense. But the thought of actual death is never far from the minds of lovers in moments of bliss. Witness Othello. If it were now to die, 'twere now to be most happy, for I fear my soul hath her content so absolute that not another comfort like to this succeeds in unknown fate. We can understand the wish to die in your peak moment of happiness. We can also understand wanting to hold on to it forever. Not everyone, even deep down, wants the same thing. Nevertheless, some desires are commonly held to be associated with love. Consider two strangers who notice each other and feel the stirring of desire. It need not be directed at any specific state of affairs. Neither yet desires to do anything in particular or that anything should happen. Rather, each begins to feel desire for the other. The desire has a target, but no aim. Mutual desire is fueled in each by the sight of each other's desire. The reciprocation, which might first consist entirely of wordless mutual gaze, intensifies a spiral of desire. It forms a feedback loop. A feedback loop can be positive or negative. Negative feedback leads to equilibrium. A thermostat shuts off the power when it is hot and turns it on when it is cold. But positive feedback, as engineers know, is a recipe for catastrophe. Only an external disruption can stop it from accelerating into some sort of explosion. In this case, luckily, the catastrophe may simply consist in a physical sexual connection. The process morphs into a new phase. The feedback loop involved in the intensifying spiral of mutual desire requires two participants, but for each one, it can be represented in a picture in which desire, pursuit, and pleasure form a cycle. This is the basis for what psychologists call operant conditioning, a simple form of learning in which pleasure marks the success of an endeavor and thereby encourages us to repeat it. In the cycle of desire and pleasure, desire motivates pursuit. Successful pursuit secures its object. Securing the object produces pleasure, and pleasure adds strength to the desire the next time around. The curse of satisfaction. There is a distressing but all too familiar phenomenon, however, which is difficult to understand on the basis of that picture. This unhappy phenomenon is forcefully described in Shakespeare's Sonnet 129. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action, and till action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, enjoyed no sooner but despised straight, past reason hunted, and no sooner had past reason hated as a swallowed bait on purpose laid to make the taker mad. mad in pursuit and in possession, so, had, having, and in quest to have, extreme, a bliss in proof and proved a very woe, before a joy proposed, behind a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well, to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. That sonnet is worth quoting in full because it contains two important ideas. The first idea is that desire itself, regardless of the attainment of its end, is painful. The second is that desire is sometimes subject to what I call the curse of satisfaction. This occurs when the satisfaction of certain desires results not in emotional contentment but in disgust. The two ideas are independent, but both represent desire itself as a highly undesirable condition, painful while it lasts, and to be succeeded only by disappointment or worse. That doesn't fit the cycle of desire and pleasure just described. Before attempting to explain where that picture went wrong, let us look more closely at these two features of desire. That love is painful is hardly news, but for many authors, including Plato and those in the Buddhist tradition, the pain of love just follows from the more general fact that all desire is inherently painful. There is a certain logic to it. Unless the desire were painful, why end it by securing its aim? Why not just lie back and enjoy it? But as Shakespeare has it, desire moves us all too brutally. It is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame. As most of us know from experience, however, this fits only a tiny proportion of desires. There can be sweet desire, delicious desire. There can be an art to delaying satisfaction in order indefinitely to prolong the savoring of desire, enjoyed for its own sake, even when it is bittersweet. Parting is such sweet sorrow. By contrast, a delicious craving is a contradiction in terms. In craving, one longs not for satisfaction, but for relief from craving, because it is aversive in itself. Not all desires are cravings. Still, even a pleasurable desire can be strongly ambivalent. The narrowly goal-directed desire for orgasm, and more generally any desire for a consummatory pleasure, aspires to its own annihilation. When the desire is itself painful, the desired consummation is an end in three senses at once, as a pleasure, as cessation of pain, and as termination. That fact may partly explain the popular association of love or sex with death. There are less extreme ways of not getting satisfaction, despite getting what you wanted. The most obvious results from mistaking what you wanted in the first place. That sort of disappointment might be avoided by specifying what you wanted more carefully. A second, more general problem is known as alesthesia, an intimidating term for the familiar fact that pleasures gradually fade with approaching satiation. The first sip tastes heavenly when I am thirsty, but the last may feel like a polite duty. A third problem is that an intensely desired pleasure may be marred by the insistent thought that it is too good to last. There is also a feeling that is especially apt to discourage a lover: disappointment at getting what you wanted because you feel, at the very moment of achieving it, that it wasn't deserved. This is related to what has been wittily dubbed Marxism, in deference not to Karl but to Groucho, who disdained to join any club that would stoop to admit him. Marxism in love is the unsettling feeling that the beloved cannot, after all, be worthy of you, since she showed such poor taste in loving you. In its most virulent form, as captured in Sonnet 129, the curse of satisfaction is indeed inconsistent with the neat cycle of desire and pleasure sketched earlier. That is because that cycle was incompletely described. It comprises five stages, not four. The missing link is reward, which sounds like just another name for pleasure, but actually refers to the mechanism that changes the way we are likely to behave. The full cycle goes like this. 1. Desire motivates us to pursue a goal. 2. Pursuit secures the object of desire. 3. The object of desire causes pleasure. 4. Pleasure triggers the reward mechanism. And 5. That mechanism reinforces the desire. Reward, or reinforcement, was the crucial step missing from the previous schema. The reward mechanism can be triggered in anomalous ways that don't require the intervention of conscious pleasure. This may seem paradoxical, but you can become directly aware of this possibility when your anticipation is excessively rosy, even though you realize that the anticipated pleasure will not match the intensity of your anticipation. All this the world well knows. It also sometimes happens that once the anticipated satisfaction arrives, the thrill is simply gone. The disconnection between steps 4 and 5 of the cycle of desire can be expressed in terms of the distinction between liking and wanting, which is underpinned by brain science. Wanting motivates action to get something, while liking characterizes the pleasure one gets from having it. I propose that we use the word vice for the condition in which we still want something that we no longer like. Some smokers seem to experience their habit as a vice in that sense. Addicts experience it in particularly virulent form. They crave the drug that first brought them intense pleasure, but now find in it not so much pleasure as mere relief from the craving itself. Sometimes, as so powerfully expressed in Shakespeare's Sonnet 147, limerence is a close cousin of addiction, a fever, a longing still for that which further nurseth the disease. But surely, as you, dear listener, no doubt have been fretting to protest, in true love things are not so grim. Lovers cannot be disappointed by getting what they want, because they take delight in the other's pleasure above all. So even if it wasn't all that good for you, you will be happy if it was good for your beloved. Lovers' desires are altruistic, if only narrowly so, in that they care only for the beloved, not for everyone else. Love, they say, lifts the lover up above his narrow concern with self, and the happiness we feel in the other's joy is not subject to the curse of satisfaction. The altruist's dilemma. No doubt that is sometimes true, but there is room for skepticism. Let us suppose that Romeo and Juliet, whose mutual gaze we left spiraling in intensity in Chapter 1, have reached that stage in which vague desire for one another has morphed into desires that something happen. At that stage, they brim with altruistic benevolence. "Your will is mine," they say. Yet that high-minded slogan can get treacherous. If taken literally, it can trap the unfortunate lovers in a kind of logical conundrum known as the altruist's dilemma. If each wants only to do the other's will, there is nothing either of them can do. They are even worse off than two purely selfish individuals, each of whom refuses to take account of the other's preferences. In a pair of egoists, each will have their own preference, and it might happen, if only by chance, that both want the same thing. What they do will then satisfy both. Two pure altruists, by contrast, cannot ground their action in any positive desire until one of them admits to an independent preference. Worse, if each strives to do what she thinks the other wants, they might go for an outcome that pleases no one. Happy families are not infrequently trapped in a recognizable form of the altruist's dilemma. Everyone hates that Thanksgiving turkey, but they all endure and even pretend to enjoy it so as to not spoil what they presume is everyone else's pleasure. If both are honest about what they really want, they can escape the dilemma. But that requires them to give up the claim that they want only whatever the other desires. In practice, lovers strive for empathy and offer tentative hypotheses about what the beloved might enjoy. By admitting to prior desires, they forfeit only an impossible form of altruism. But even for sensibly imperfect altruists, the lover's concern for the beloved can be hemmed in with small print. An implicit proviso is infrequently attached to the desire for the lover's happiness. I want your happiness above all things, providing only that I am the one to provide it. Only a few steps away from this is the explicit threat expressed in Carmen's famous aria in Bizet's opera. Si je t'aime, prends garde à toi. If I love you, watch out. That proviso illustrates how toxic forms of the desire for possession can stalk lovers even when they have abjured cruder forms of possession. You love the other for the autonomous spirit that he is, and you want never to curb his deepest human dignity and worth, which is, as the philosopher Kant stressed, his inalienable freedom. It's just that you also want him to exercise that freedom in the right ways. God himself, after all, had this problem when he bestowed on his creature the precious gift of free will. Freedom is essential to a creature made in his image, but woe betide you if you misuse it. God will be very sad, but a deal is a deal, and he will just have to send you to hell forever. That double message opens up in the nether world of human beings the emotions that make up the many faces of jealousy. Jealousy is the stuff of opera, tragedy, and farce. It also plagues the life of ordinary couples. There is always more small print. It is rare for lovers not to regard themselves as bound by a host of petty requirements and prohibitions. Author Laura Kipnis has collected a list from actual reports of what people in couples are not allowed to do. You can't leave the house without saying where you're going. You can't not say what time you'll return. You can't stay out past midnight or 11 or 10 or dinner time or not come right home after work. You can't go out when the other person feels like staying home. You can't go to parties alone. You can't go out just to go out because you can't not be considerate of the other person's worries about where you are or their natural insecurities that you're not where you should be or about where you could be instead. You can't make plans without consulting the other person, particularly not evenings and weekends. The list goes on for over 9 pages. All these specific prohibitions presumably spring from some more general needs and desires. To be wanted, to be cared for, to matter to the beloved, to be special. In short, to be loved in return. But also not to shame us, since now we are an entity and each can feel ashamed of what the other does. That, at any rate, is what is implied by some of the items on Kipnis's list. You can't return the rent-a-car without throwing out the garbage because the mate thinks it looks bad, even if you insist that cleaning the car is rolled into the rates. Every couple, whether happy or unhappy, is different. Or at least they should be. Given the boundless diversity of human individuals, we would expect as many styles of loving as there are pairs of lovers. In fact, judging by the ways in which lovers are characterized, there are surprisingly few. Books periodically appear promising a typology of loves, but the types on offer usually reduce the limitless abundance of possibilities to half a dozen. Later, I shall speculate that categories are not intended to capture the experience of love, but to make it easier to talk about. For the moment, and in the rest of this chapter, I return to some more general questions about desire. The champagne verdict. Some desires are grounded in one or more other desires. Call them reason-based. That sounds, well, reasonable. But in a certain sense, it means you may not really desire what you have reason to desire. For what you want as a means to something else might not be desirable in itself. Wanting to get milk is a reason for going to the store. Getting to the store is a means. The milk, too, is a means, and you can list a train of reasons until you get to something you just want and for which you can give no further reason. Call that a reason-free desire, for something you want for its own sake. If you are thirsty, then you just want to drink. But isn't the desire to drink, you might ask, based on your desire to live? Isn't that a reason to drink? Yes, in a way. Some physiological mechanism will normally make you feel thirsty when you are dehydrated. But you don't need to know anything about dehydration to be thirsty. And someone who has entirely lost the will to live might still feel thirsty. Wanting to drink is a reason-free desire. It gives you reason to want to do other things, such as pouring water or getting money to buy milk. But it doesn't itself need a reason. To which kind do love's desires belong? For an answer to this question, let us turn to a court of love, an institution entrusted with deciding delicate questions of concern to the age of courtly love. In 1176, a court of love presided on by the Countess of Champagne considered the question, "Is love possible between people united by marriage?" This was the verdict. "We state and affirm by this judgment that love cannot extend its power to a married couple, for lovers give one another everything freely, without obligation or any necessity. Conjugal partners, by contrast, are committed to doing one another's will and not to deny anything to one another." In this judgment, giving something freely is given three contrasts: obligation, necessity, and commitment. All three provide reasons to act. The Countess of Champagne's verdict implies that love moves us to act either without reasons or from reasons entirely different from those three. One might also ask whether the lover has reasons to love in the first place. In the next chapter, we shall discuss that question, but here we look only at the reasons that love provides. Why should those reasons not motivate those who are married couples? Undeniably, love makes us do things, and so do reasons, at least when we're being reasonable. The Champagne verdict implies that they just do it in different ways. We have all met people who greet misfortune with the slogan that everything happens for a reason. Their confidence is irritating because, well, there's no good reason for it. Most things happen by chance, which is not a reason. But the very inanity of that slogan is useful. It incites us to confront the fact that it is not easy to say what counts as a reason. Reasons contrast with chance, but they are more likely to be confused with causes. The two words, cause and reason, are sometimes used interchangeably. There's little difference between saying that someone has a reason to be sad and saying they have cause to be sad. And yet only people have reasons. Inanimate objects don't. Neither do plants or, as far as we can tell, insects. When someone claims they have cause to complain, they might instead have said, "I have good reason to complain." What they really mean is that their complaint is justified. By contrast, if a spark in the wiring caused a fire, we wouldn't say the wiring had good reason to burst into flames. Only reasons justify. In fact, only good reasons can justify. Sometimes we act, or believe, for bad reasons. Choosing a Vuitton bag because it's the most expensive might be a bad reason. But a bad reason can still be a reason, as long as we can understand how someone might think it provides them with a justification for something done or believed. You can be caused to do something without a reason. Think, for example, of the way your doctor tests your reflexes by tapping a spot below the knee. Your leg jerks forward and has been caused to do so, but you didn't have any reason to do it. In fact, you didn't really do it. It just happened to you. Pain is like that. If you stepped on a nail, you might have a pain and be aware of a cause, but stepping on the nail wasn't a reason for your pain. Pain needs no reason. Perhaps love is like that. In short, both reasons and causes make things happen. When reasons make things happen, they are causes, too. But only people with minds capable of thoughts that can justify their choices can have reasons. Unfortunately, this picture needs to be complicated because the distinction between what you can and cannot choose is not always so neat. Belief is a case in point. We have reasons for beliefs, and yet, in most cases, we don't choose what to believe. When belief is optional, that is because the reasons on either side were poor or, as we say, not compelling. But most reasons to believe are compelling. You can't just decide that 2 plus 2 make 5, or that the car you see barreling towards you as you cross the road isn't really there. Neither can you follow the White Queen's advice to Alice to believe 6 impossible things before breakfast. Perhaps love's desires work that way, too. Many people are convinced that their love, like their belief that 2 and 2 is 4, is both inescapable and grounded in reasons, even if the reasons cannot be articulated. If desire and belief are alike in this respect, perhaps the explanation is also the same for both. In the case of belief, the explanation is that any belief, say, the cat is on the mat, is constituted essentially by the network of implications in which the cat is on the mat is embedded. You can give reasons for thinking that the cat is on the mat, and that belief itself is a reason for other beliefs. Your beliefs seem to be compelled by the facts of the world because most of them are held in place by your entire system of beliefs. You can't choose not to believe the cat is on the mat when doing so would require you to reject innumerable other beliefs as well. That cats look like that, that you're not mad or dreaming, etc. Sometimes, however, when you have no compelling reason to believe or disbelieve, you get to weigh the pros and cons. And in those cases, it seems plausible to say you choose to believe one or the other. Some beliefs, by contrast, seem so obvious that they don't seem to depend on anything else. The philosopher René Descartes thought, "I exist" was one of those. Of course, you can wonder whether Descartes existed, but you can't doubt that you do. That belief is the equivalent of a reason-free desire. It is, we might say, a reason-free belief. Could love's desires resemble belief, which both requires and provides reasons, and yet isn't normally chosen? If not all desires are reason-based, that must be true of love's desires as well. We saw that your desire to drink may be explained physiologically or psychologically by your dehydration without giving you a reason for your thirst. Similarly, as Eryximachus first suggested, some of the desires of love may be explained by various levels of physiology and psychology. But in the heat of the moment, you have no thought of that. Your desire to drink, or your desire to caress, or to gaze at, or to take care of, or to spend the rest of your life with someone, might be more like the belief that you exist. You haven't chosen to feel it, and you haven't the option not to. Suppose you have just met someone. You might try to decide if you like them or not. You're not sure. But depending on your temperament and on impressions you can scarcely articulate, you decide to give your new acquaintance the benefit of the doubt. Or not, as the case may be. Your attitude to that new acquaintance is then rather like your belief in some controverted piece of information you have read about. When there is no strong inclination either way, you may feel you have a choice. But more frequently, love is like thirst. It gives you reasons to do things, but in itself seems not to need any reason at all. It is reason-free. We can discuss the Countess's verdict in terms of distinction between reason-based and reason-free desires. The desires that spring from love, she holds, are of the second kind. Anything you want to do for your lover, you just want to do. In the same way, when you want to smell the flower, you don't want it as a means, unless you're employed by a horticultural enterprise that requires you to assess its quality. Marriage provides reasons for assuming certain duties, and the duties, in turn, provide reasons to take care of your spouse. So, taking care of your spouse is no longer a pure, reason-free desire. Writing just a few decades before our verdict was rendered, Eloise, legendary lover of the philosopher Abelard, gave this an additional twist. If two spouses are not convinced that no worthier man exists and no finer woman exists anywhere on earth, then above all else, you will always be seeking that one thing you think is best, to have the best of all possible husbands or the best of all possible wives. The implication is that spouses not only have a duty of care, in addition, they have a duty to believe their spouse to be the best of all possible. Unless they do, they might be on the lookout for a more perfect one. But as they are married, it is their further duty not to do so. We might call it the duty of blindness. We can sum all this in a syllogism. 1. By definition, no reason-based desire can be purely reason-free. 2. When we love, our desire for the other's happiness is caused by love, much as thirst may be caused by dehydration, but it is in itself purely reason-free. 3. Husband and wife, by virtue of their contract of marriage, are obliged to take care of one another. 4. Their desire to take care of one another is therefore necessarily grounded in obligations. 5. Duties and obligations constitute grounds for reason-based desires. 6. Therefore, the husband and wife's desires can only be reason-based desires. 7. Therefore, it is impossible for husband and wife, however mutually benevolent, to be motivated by the sort of reason-free desires that alone belong to love. The conclusion follows logically from premises 1 through 3. If we want to reject it, we need to reject one of those premises. The second premise seems most vulnerable, but what is wrong with it exactly? What springs to mind is that it is based on an excessively abstract ideal of love. It is just the kind of abstract conception that led to the altruist's dilemma. In the end, that dilemma presented no real threat because it would be a delusion to seriously believe that one's desires could be purely altruistic. Any additional motivation would add a reason to your pure desire for the other's happiness, and so invalidate that desire's claim to be purely reason-free. In short, our desires are too messy for premise 2 to hold in the real world. Still, even an idealized concept can be useful. We all learned some elementary physics in school in which we were taught about such non-existent things as frictionless surfaces. Such simplifications were an indispensable aid to understanding. We can think of the reason-free desires of ideal love in the same spirit. That idealized concept gives us a baseline in terms of which we can take stock of the enormous baggage carried by our everyday wants and desires. Myriad murky motivations muddle the decisions we allegedly make out of love. Think, for example, of the 1,138 rights, obligations, or privileges that married people in the United States are blessed or burdened by. Those who marry for love, as many people claim to do, can affect to ignore all of these, since marriage is a contract of which hardly anyone ever reads the fine print. Nevertheless, the complexity of those unread clauses in every marriage contract serves to remind us that what seem to be the purest reason-free desires are seldom anything of the kind.